sinners and choosers and lovers and dreamers, hypocrites and cynical bastards, and anyone who is dead inside. Welcome to Choose Your Own Religion. My name is Joe. Thank you guys for tuning in this week, as every week. Real pleasure to have you. My guest today is Jason Van Glass. He's a comedian out here in LA. He produces and runs all kinds of stuff, as you'll hear. And as you'll also hear in this conversation, you'll hear me being kind of frustrated early on, and which maybe it was because of my interviewing. Who knows? But we ended up settling into a really good conversation about meditation and Buddhism and the comedy, and Jason opened up about his own childhood. So I really appreciate that. Again, follow Jason on Twitter. I'll have the links to the show notes, and he's the only person with his name anyway, so if you just Google him, you'll definitely find him. And also, two quick fun things I got coming up. If you're in the Baltimore, D.C. area, I'm going to be at the Charm City Comedy Festival. That is in Baltimore. It's going to be at Zissimo's Bar. I'm going to be performing on Thursday, May 11th at 8:30. You should check that out. You should check out the rest of the festival. It's going to be a lot of fun. I would love to see any of you sinners and choosers there. Also, if you're in Los Angeles, I'm going to do another live Choose Your Own Religion on June 3rd. That's Saturday, June 3rd. Still working on the lineup, but just like last time, it's not a podcast. It's a live, kind of fucked up worship service thing. So I hope to see you guys there. And if you like this show, boy, have I got the website for you. It's chooseyourownreligion.com. You can find, you can find everything from old episodes to the blog posts that I've been doing this year. Every week this year, I've been going to a different spiritual or religious place or having some kind of different experience and writing about it, probably in too many words, but it's there. If you're interested, I've gone everywhere from fucking Gnostic churches to dance classes to good old classic Methodism to everywhere in between. So if you're interested in that, you can find those on the website. It's called This Week in Spiritual Narcissism. It's on the blog. And again, iTunes and Stitcher. If you want to leave a rating or review on anywhere you want, that would be great. I would love you for that. And if you want a sticker, let me know. And on top of all that, if you just want to email me and say hello or talk to me or whatever or ask whatever the fuck you want to email me about, you can email me at joe@joequint.net. I love talking to you guys, and I hope to hear from you soon. Anyway, that's all. Thank you guys for listening again. Please sit down, focus your breath and all of your attention on Jason Van Glass.
Allow the soothing music and uplifting affirmations to center your heart and mind in an awareness of God's love.
Wake up, my dear sinners. Wake up from your deep rest. Won't you say your prayers? Know that you are blessed. I love you, oh, but Jesus loves you the best. And I hope that you choose your own religion.
This is a very Buddhist start to the podcast.
Indeed.
Very short. You're sitting, I mean, your hands are even in a sort of like meditative type, what do you call it? Clasp? What is this? Clasping? Grasping?
I don't know.
Well, now
I agree.
Now you're really doing it. Thanks for coming.
Doing a lot of visual things for the podcast.
Mm-hmm. Seems like you're trying to like tell me something with your eyes. That's not, I can't tell if it's positive or negative. Doesn't really feel positive.
I wasn't trying to tell you anything.
Cool. Well, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So I know the rundown basically because you have a bit on a really funny bit on your current Buddhist dabblings.
Yes.
But I want to go back earlier. So you grew up in the Bay Area, right?
Right.
Right. Parents. Super not into anything, right?
Yeah, even super implies a strong... They just weren't into it. It wasn't even a thing.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't like they were fighting against it.
They're not ex-Catholics. They're just not anything.
Mm-hmm. What did they... Did their family... Did they have grow up with really anything or ex-anything?
Mm-hmm. Even their grandparents or my grandparents are pretty chill, I think.
Yeah? What were your grandparents?
That's what I'm saying. It's like I don't... My grandparents didn't seem particularly religious even if they... I guess probably had some affiliation.
Mm-hmm. And you don't know what it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No idea.
So you were just, how then were you raised, like, when you were growing up then, what did they teach you in general, like, about religion? Like, they're like, okay, so you're going to be at school with all these, like, religious kids who, no, like, are going to tell you things about Jesus.
Northern California, so that wasn't true.
No religious kids.
Fair number of Jews and Christians tended to be, like, Asian immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
But the San Francisco Bay Area is not a hotbed of evangelical Christianity.
Right, right. But even then, I mean, you're running into, every now and then you're running into people. But so that wasn't even a factor for them to be like, you don't even, yeah. you never came across a Christian where like, oh, cool, like, well, who's this Jesus person?
Yeah, it's
never happened.
It's a different world up there.
Well, yeah, sure. Well, then, so what is elementary school like? It's just nobody, religion is just not like a factor at all.
No, why would it be a factor?
Well, because I don't know, because I grew up in the South, where it's obviously a huge factor.
Yeah.
So this is just me trying to talk, and
I didn't even like, consider, you know, until this
podcast,
moment.
I thought I would. I didn't even consider and ask you
until
stuff.
This moment that it could have been a factor in elementary school. Like, why would religion be a factor of third grade?
Well, I'll tell
to
you.
Me, to me, that's like I had not even stopped to consider that possibility.
Well, I'll tell you why it matters in the South, because you're like literally everybody you know is some kind of Christian, more or less. I mean, and if they're not, they just don't talk about it. Like, it's assumed. It's just it's like fish swimming in water, where you say the Pledge of Allegiance, everybody's like into the Pledge of Allegiance, the under God part. Everybody's like going to church, or everybody belongs to some church, or at the very least, even if they're not going to church, surely they like pray and they're like into that. Now that might, again, I'm sure there was a silent group of people who were just totally not into that at all, but that was the cultural norm. So cultural norm in the Bay Area, nothing like that.
Not at all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know even where to begin, how different it is.
Yeah.
I mean, growing up, you assume wherever you are is normal, and then later you find out how you're hometown or area differs from the rest of the country.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the San Francisco Bay Area, of course, very liberal, very progressive oriented.
But even then, there's like, I mean, there's a religious new age-ish type vibe up there in terms of like a psychedelic movement, in terms of, I mean, the whole, I mean, it's stereotypical, but like whole Grateful Dead, hippie stuff, you know, there's a whole, all this Eastern influence. I mean, the Eastern influence in the United States was essentially born there and started there. I mean, Alan Watts is kind of tramped around up there. So that what
I did encounter that as a small child, but I agree. Yeah. Like for sure. The 60s are still a part of the Bay Area, but
were your parents a part of that at all?
Not really. No,
no. What did they do?
They're both, employees of the California State Fund system, which is the state's, public insurance, basically public option, insurer of last resort. My father worked there his whole career. My mother worked there for most of her career.
Were they like, so they weren't, for some reason,
and they were basically tech people.
Gotcha.
Maybe not the tech people you think of now, but because they started in the late 60s or early 70s. But my father was eventually head of IT and my mother worked in tech.
Gotcha.
At the company.
Okay, that's kind of like my grandfather worked for NASA in Huntsville, Alabama, but he was an accountant. So it's like, when you think of like a space person, he's not really like exactly what you think.
My parents don't have engineering degrees, but they both ended up in tech because somebody had to take it over, and my mother was an early adapter and a computer enthusiast and put her English degree to good use eventually working in the tech department and managing, you know, in the 80s they have these huge servers and huge rooms, floors of the building are devoted to computers.
So what about you when you were a kid, what kind of like, I mean, if you had to put yourself, like I was like, I ended up being like a theater kid. I was kind of into like emo music and musical theater and that kind of shit. What kind of, if you had to put yourself in any kind of, I mean, did you fall into any box when you were a kid in terms of like,
I was in the comic books, that category of stuff.
What got you in the comic books?
I don't know. I think everyone was doing it in 92. Spawn was big. And I was like artistic, so I would draw on stuff. So I think that was especially the connection that made me stick with comic books, was that I was exhibiting some sort of like artistic intent. Mm-hmm. And so my parents and of course teachers, everyone was very encouraging of like, oh, drawing and painting.
Mm-hmm. And you're, I mean, you're, okay, let me just, I'll just say, you're striking me right now as a fairly passionless guy.
Great. I don't disagree.
So no passions as a kid, nothing now.
I mean, I was a big collector of things. I still sort of collect things.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't think I've become Buddhist because I don't think Buddhism has made me like a very grounded, calm person. I was always a very low key person.
So I wasn't suggesting Buddhism made you that way, but it's more that you're like, oh, these are like this is more my speed of like, this is how I've always kind of felt and processed the world.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I'd known that for a long time, but only got into the practice of meditation recently.
How recently?
A couple years ago. I mean, I sort of edged into it.
Mm-hmm. And what is your meditation practice look like?
Well, I go to Kadampa Modern Buddhism, mm-hmm. Which has maybe 800 locations worldwide, but also one very conveniently located near my apartment in Los Feliz.
Mm-hmm.
Kadampa is just a meditation without... it's founded by a Tibetan monk, but it's shaved off all religious, traditional customs. It's just meditation. The guy that founded it believes meditation would be helpful for anyone, regardless of belief in God or belief in spirits.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a place kind of like a yoga class where you can just go at a specific time and someone will lead a guided meditation and you pay $5.
Mm-hmm. And that's it. So you're not like, you're not involved in any other like community aspect of it then?
No, and I'm not sure there's much of a, there are volunteers there and stuff, but it doesn't seem like a big,
mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem like there's a lot of extracurricular activities there. It is, like I say, kind of like a yoga class or some sort of exercise boot camp or something. Like it's just a thing. It's a way for you to schedule it into your day. And I like going there and doing that. I have attention deficit disorder.
Mm-hmm.
So I think something that kept me out of meditation for something that, you know, I could have started 10 years ago. I was aware of it and I thought it'd be a good fit for me was just the inability to sit down and do anything for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So by going to a place that doesn't have any distractions and has other people doing it, someone else keeping track of that you're doing it for 30 minutes or whatever, mm-hmm. makes it much easier for me.
Gotcha. So it's a totally pragmatic sort of practical thing.
Very.
Yeah. There's no, there's definitely no extracurricular in terms of extra spiritual or extra physical.
No, it has no religious elements, although the guy that founded it is involved in many other side projects, as you may know from my stage performances.
Such as wanting to kill the Dalai Lama.
Sure, he's got a point. He's an actual Tibetan monk.
What is his point?
Well,
Dalai Lama is like such a nice guy. Classically nice guy.
You've met him?
I think
the Dalai Lama is a nice guy.
I've hosted him.
This guy's point is that Tibetan Buddhism, distinct from maybe other cultural, you know, Japanese or Indian Buddhism and whatnot, Tibetan Buddhism over the years incorporated a lot of, I think, maybe the existing nature gods and spirit gods and ancestor gods that were in Tibet before Buddhism arrived. Tibetan Buddhism is full of a pantheon of spirits and candle lighting and mysticism. And in the 1890s or early 1900s, perhaps, one of the minor gods of Tibetan Buddhism, the cosmic spirit of vengeance, rained vengeance down on enemies of Tibetan Buddhism within Tibet. So various heretics or branch people that spoke out against the mainstream Buddhism. So like I'm just going to spitball a number here, but I think the Dalai Lama's branch of Buddhism only represents about 85% of Tibetan Buddhists.
Mm-hmm.
The other 15, like most, you know, religions, Christianity or something, there's all of these Protestants and Catholics and Lutherans and Presbyterians and XYZ. And the same is true of Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Tibet, there were different monks or different religious movements that would try and break away or contradict the Tibetan, the Dalai Lama's main branch of Tibetan Buddhism. And about 100 years ago, misfortune befell a whole series of people. They died in floods. Heretics or people that were threatening the power of or the truth of the Dalai Lama's branch died in mudslides and were struck by lightning and just a and so one of the sort of maybe equally powerful like pantheon of like sub gods, the cosmic spirit of vengeance, was credited. And mainstream Tibetan Buddhists and the monks venerated the cosmic spirit of vengeance for punishing people that threatened their belief system or heretics. The cosmic spirit of vengeance became maybe the most revered god in the pantheon of gods. And when the current Dalai Lama became the Dalai Lama, of course, you know, China has invaded Tibet. They've taken over. All of Tibetan Buddhism is imperiled. This Dalai Lama, in exile, made some changes. He renounced the worship of the cosmic spirit of vengeance in order to unite all of Tibetan Buddhists outside of internal sectarian wars and united against the threat of China, and also to make the religion seem less threatening to British and American people that don't want to, I think, would prefer to have a simple, like, it's beneficial to the Tibetan Buddhists' cause that this is a religion of peace and not a religion of venerating the cosmic spirit of vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the things the Dalai Lama did in the 70s was denounce the practice of worshiping this cosmic spirit. But of course, that was highly divisive among people who are 12th generation monks. It's the same as if the Pope denounce the Holy Ghost.
Right.
A lot of people, a lot of professional Catholics would be very upset by that and would not accept that. They would say that the Pope was the anti-Pope.
Mm.
And so the same thing has happened in Tibetan Buddhism, where a small faction of followers and monks believe that this Dalai Lama has compromised a core belief of Tibetan Buddhism. Not a belief I hold, but I don't follow any of the religious elements of Tibetan Buddhism, but they believe that this, the current Dalai Lamas, they picked the wrong guy, basically.
Gotcha. So you, like, as you said, you don't have a dog in that fight, really.
No, not at all.
So really, I mean, if anything, you probably agree with the Dalai Lama then, and that you would, if it was up to you personally.
I don't have a side in the fight. Like I say, like, I don't think we should be assassinating anyone or like in any form of holy war, but I can see it from their perspective. If the Pope denounced the Holy Ghost, a lot of Catholics, a lot of high ranking Catholics,
right,
would think that we picked the wrong Pope.
But isn't a lack of endorsement of the Holy Ghost basically a denouncement of the Holy Ghost? You're like, I don't really think the Holy Ghost is a real thing.
Right. I mean, we are seeing that with the current Pope. We see that with every Pope.
Right.
The Pope makes certain pronouncements and there's rumblings among the followers.
Mm-hmm.
And so this current Pope, who happens to be like a quite liberal Pope, has, you know, makes waves every once in a while. And that's all that's happened with Tibetan Buddhism, is that and another part of it is, much like this current liberal pope that is coming from South America, the first, I think, maybe New World Pope.
Mm-hmm.
The current Dalai Lama, the one we know and love, is was born of maybe modest means. Mm-hmm. He's not from a long line of lamas or monks. And I know it's a surprise, but reincarnation of the Dalai Lamas tends to happen in really powerful, politically well-connected families. Traditionally, that's just where they decide to come back. Like, you would too, if you were going to be reincarnated. You'd
sure,
be like,
yeah,
I want to be the king's son. And that's typically where the Dalai Lamas were reborn to. This current Dalai Lama isn't coming from a particularly powerful family or a line of monks.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas many monks are. It's a profession you pass on to your son. So many master meditators are 12th generation, or they're carrying on a legacy.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like almost, do you feel like the way you're describing this, and it's a lot more detailed than I certainly knew. It seems like you're almost, because like you're, it seems like you're pointing out the that there's a lot of the same sort of nepotism, and maybe not even nepotism in Christianity, but some of the sort of this weird maybe hidden hypocrisy, or this weird like,
well, yeah, it's human. I think
political aspect of it.
Americans are always so excited to find out that there's a holy war happening where one Tibetan monk is trying to kill another, because our view of Buddhism is so simple. It's just like pacifists.
Right.
They think every Tibetan, they think every Buddhist is a pacifist, and
or at worst case,
but like Christianity is a religion of peace too. We just know more about it, so we understand that like wars have been fought over Christianity, even right. though like one of Jesus's main things was like peace.
Right, right. Or worst case, we think of like the Rage Against the Machine cover with the guy immolating yeah. himself. You're like, okay, well, that's still pacifism.
Getting run over by tanks and not harming flies and all of that's true. But like I say, like, yeah, religion, like the leader of Tibetan Buddhism, of course, is 9 times out of 10 born to a very powerful, well-connected,
mm-hmm.
You know, son or cousin or something. And it's that network that plays it. It's... yeah, they're humans. Of course, of course it happens that way.
Yeah, yeah. So with your own meditation practice, what have you, and you've said it's been a couple of years now. I mean, have you, besides just helping you focus, I mean, has it had any kind of effect on any other quality? Like, have you noticed other parts of you have maybe grown? I mean, because like they talk about like meditation being the practice, and that there's this whole eightfold path, and part of it, you know, and the idea that you're developing compassion maybe along the way, you're developing this like right action, these right speech, this mm-hmm. like this certain, this mindfulness will then carry over into concrete actions. Do you feel like that has been the case with you?
I do it because I like the way it makes me feel, and it's very hard. Mm-hmm. I think it's hard for anyone. But when you get into that zone, it's a really nice, focused, relaxed, uplifting feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do it because I like the way it makes me feel, and I do feel like doing it and experiencing that feeling has made me a happier, more grateful person. And it's, I don't think I'm good at meditating. I don't think I'm like great at charity or whatever, but I think I am on the right trajectory where I'm on a day-to-day basis, I am happier, and that's mm-hmm. why I do it.
What's, so like, can you say specifically, like, what, because I'll do, I mean, I meditate in the morning, but, and I've gone through different little types over the years where sometimes I'm focusing purely on my breathing, and then, mm-hmm. you know, maybe I'm counting breaths, and then I'm returning to it mm-hmm. once I lose my train of thought, or sometimes I'm trying to do like a body scanning thing. Sometimes I'm like hyper listening to my environment, and then again, once I notice my train of thought going off somewhere, then I'll return. What kind of style do you do?
Exactly that. I mean, there's different traditions, or different, you know, some people have mantras and some people focus on the breath.
Mm-hmm. You're not a mantra guy, not a...
I don't do mantra, but I haven't really tried it. I have nothing against it.
No TM or anything like that.
No, don't no. have the money. So yeah, I try and just focus on my breath, but mainly just like you stop your mind from running. The goal, it's a game, and you're trying to stop yourself from having thoughts about what you're going to do later, or what you have to go shopping for, or like that road rage you had earlier. Or
is it a stopping, or is it more of like a catching yourself doing it?
Yeah. So you're like one, you can focus on anything. So one reason you focus on your breath is to focus on your breath to the exclusion of, oh, I have to send that email.
Right.
I wonder, like, Get Out was a good movie. I should.
It was a good movie.
And
though.
So it's just a game where you're trying to stop your mind from wandering. And when your mind wanders, you simply observe that it's wandered and return to the breath
mm-hmm.
or return to your mantra or return to. You could pick anything,
uh-huh.
but the game is this: your brain is going to really try and make you think about things from you haven't thought of in years. Think about things you have to do later.
Yeah,
make plans. Your brain is designed to just bombard you with that stuff.
Totally. Like I think somebody described it as your brain. I think maybe Ram Dass even talked about it as like your brain is like your mind is like a conveyor belt, like Lucy in I Love Lucy, like the conveyor belt with the chocolate, whatever. It's just gonna keep going. You can't stop the conveyor belt from moving, but you can sort of hop off the conveyor belt and not be
and
like
you can
watch it.
You
watch
can just
the
watch
conveyor
the
belt.
Stuff go by.
Yeah, like you're not gonna ever completely shut it down.
And but when you experience that, when you succeed a little bit in terms of kind of getting rid of those running thoughts, that running commentary, the thoughts that are random thoughts coming in from everywhere, when you are kind of able to like push those aside and just like kind of get them off in the distance and not be caught up in them or think about them, it is a just a interesting and unique feeling.
Yeah.
And one that makes me just feel sort of contented or happy.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it definitely, I think I'm just better at life in general when I do it, because I think there's a much more of a distance of the separation from my immediate emotion or my immediate thought that, so I'm not as much of a slave to those per se, of I'm just going to react purely based on, you know, I mean, anger is the classic one that we don't want to react to sometimes, you know, whatever it is. And it is funny when I hear people, tell me if you've heard what other ones you hear. These are the two most common ones I hear when I ask people why they don't, I don't ask everybody why they don't meditate. That would be really offensive. But when people say like, oh, I don't want to meditate, it's usually one of like, oh, I get bored, or like there's no way I could do that. And they're like, oh, my mind is just too crazy, which to me is like an overweight person being like, the
reason to do it. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. I mean, are those the main ones you hear? Do you hear any other like things of like why people don't?
I don't know. I guess I haven't had those conversations with people too much.
Uh-huh. Did you ever have a period where you didn't want to go, or like, was there any resistance?
I have like, you know, severe attention deficit disorder, I would say. And I only started taking medicine for it. I should have just been taking medicine as a child, but I only started taking medicine for it as an adult, which really changed my life.
Really?
Because the medicine works. Ritalin works.
Uh-huh. But tell me about that too, because I know people over, I know, I'm not saying it's, I totally believe you that you have it. I'm just saying that in general, it's like the cliche is people say we've overprescribed ADD in this country.
That's an interesting cliche, because that cliche is funded by Scientology.
Really?
Scientology, of course, anti-psychiatric medicine.
Oh.
And they're one of the main funders and propagators of the idea that we shouldn't be giving anyone, especially children, psychiatric medicine. But if the medicine works, some of them work better than others. Like, I think antidepressants don't work very well and have side effects that you do want to be extremely careful with children. But like, the thing is, Ritalin works. It's changed my life 100% for the better.
That's awesome.
And I should have been on it years ago, and I think what stopped it from happening wasn't that I wasn't diagnosed correctly. I was. I think what stopped it from happening was a general societal like suspicion of giving medicine to children.
Yeah.
And that suspicion is 100% funded by Scientology, who I really respect their taste in architecture.
So you were diagnosed with ADD as a kid, then, you're saying?
They knew something was up, and I think they knew it was ADHD.
Huh. And then,
because I was struggling and I had learning disabilities.
Gotcha. So it wasn't, it's not just a like, oh, this kid just loves running around. He can't, you know, he can't color inside the lines. It's like, that sucks, man. I'm sorry to hear you went through that.
It's fine. Worked out great.
And then when did you start taking it as a Ritalin as an adult?
I was like 26 or 27.
Mm-hmm. And so with ADD, then, it's like, this is basically a doctor saying, like, even more than the average person, like, because even though, like, meditation can work for everybody, whether they have ADD or not, because I think, because it is a function of mind that'll keep generating.
It's like going to the gym, is my analogy for it.
Right. But, like, ADD is like a hyper version of what everybody has of that mind conveyor belt thing. It's just like you have twice as many conveyor belts.
You have
going twice as fast.
Less control over your mind.
Yeah.
You can't do things you want to do.
So that what was the biggest like change then for you? Just being able to focus and actually accomplish
stuff. Being able to get things done, things I wanted to do for a long time. It gave me control over my life.
Were you like when you going, like, let's say, did you have, I mean, you know, if you don't want to talk about it, that's fine. But was there like a rock bottom moment for like your lack of focus, or was it just a kind of a gradual, eventual, like, yeah, it's time to just try this?
I think
shit.
It was the realization that it was just textbook ADHD and there was a cure.
Yeah. And you're like, well,
and that
might
even
well
though
try
I'd
it.
Been in, they tested me for things in elementary school and I couldn't spell, but I thought maybe they'd run the tests and what I didn't realize it was just attention deficit disorder. And realizing that and getting the prescription for it, it was life changing.
Yeah. And how did
give your kids drugs?
And how did, how has being on Ritalin affected? Because, I mean, the way I'm thinking of it now, or have been thinking of it, has been like exactly like an academic format or in like a productivity format. I mean, did that have an effect on your like interpersonal relationships too?
Maybe it couldn't have hurt.
Yeah.
I mean, pre-Ritalin, to watch a DVD that I wanted to watch, I would get the DVD. 2 days later, I would watch like 30 minutes of the DVD. I'd make dinner. I'd watch like 30 minutes of the DVD. And it wasn't like you know what I mean? It turned to everything. And like, I couldn't stop and do anything. I couldn't read more than a chapter of a book. And to read that chapter would take 2 days to pick up the book.
You're just totally...
So every part of my life was really... I just didn't have control over my getting things done or actions.
It's just
just homework, but like watching movies.
So like any kind of distraction would just immediately just...
The impulse to just like get up and do something else for 20 minutes.
Right. So I'm just picturing that could, I'm sure in relationships that could potentially hurt somebody, be like, hey, fucking pay attention to me. And you're like, no, but I can't. Or did that not factor in at all?
I'm sure it did.
And so you see meditation as sort of like a maintenance thing more than if Ritalin is more of a direct like cure and changing your brain chemistry, where does meditation fit in with that?
I see it as going to the gym, not with any goal in mind, but like when you go to the gym for an hour, you feel
better. Yeah.
Like if you run for an hour, you just feel better. You feel better the next day. You have more energy. And I see, for me, meditation is the same type of practical thing. Like it's a gym for your mind, and you can have a good gym day or a bad gym. Like you can meditate and it won't maybe even go that well. You don't have a good session. You just keep getting distracted or whatever, but the better you get at it, you carry that with you the rest of the week or the rest of the day, where you're just a little bit more grounded, a little bit more in charge of your thoughts and your thinking, your mental clarity. You're not in a fog. You're not in a daze of getting things done or racing from one thing to the next.
Yeah. And sometimes with me, I'm like, it's more of the effect of when I don't meditate, then that's when I feel like, oh God, like then it gets fucking crazy.
But I think that even the analogy stays there, because it's like if you are going to the gym for a while and then you stop, you feel tireder.
Right. Exactly.
Like you didn't work out, and so now you're more tired.
Right. But you like take it for after a certain point, you feel
a paradox. Yeah.
Yeah. At a certain point, you can feel like a plateau, though. Like it's a false. Maybe it's a plateau is still higher than the ground that it's in reference to, but. On that plateau, you can be like, well, why am I even like, out here? And so do you ever have these like frustrating moments with your meditation practice, or is it sort of,
I guess because I haven't done it, I'm doing it for 30 minutes, like three times a week or something. I haven't gone on some retreat where you do it for 7 days straight. I haven't.
Would you?
I got other stuff to do. It seems interesting, but like, I can't, that's not what I would take a 7 day vacation to do.
Sure. Yeah.
But because I haven't met that point of it yet. I'm not doing it at a level that is like a place where I get frustrated with it.
Sure. I'm kind of, this is, I don't know why this has popped in my head. Is this funny the way you were like, I got other stuff to do? It just struck me as like a funny this, I accused you earlier of being a passionless person. I don't, maybe perhaps that was unfair.
Very true. Not true that it's unfair, just like a good observation.
But so what is there? I'm curious, is there like a philosophical underpinning of this passionlessness, or is it just the way you kind of always have been?
Yeah, I think I'm always that way, and any philosophical beliefs have come later to match.
Uh-huh. Are you into like nihilism?
No.
No. Emptiness?
I do believe that if you're bothered by something and you can't change it, then you should just let it go.
Sure, yeah.
And that's hard, but that's like a real belief I have. But I think that belief is coming out of some sort of pre-existing setting in my personality of just being very chill.
Super chill.
So, and of course, I get up, like anyone, I get upset about things or worried about stuff, but for me, it's like a little bit of a life hack where it's like, but if you can't change it,
yeah,
then worrying about it's not, if worrying about it's not going to fix it, then you shouldn't worry about it.
Sure.
If worrying about it is the, gives you the, you know, motivation you need to take action, then of course, or if worrying about it is a way of reconciling some sort of problem, then of course. But if it's just being mad, like I can't stop Donald Trump.
Right.
And I think everything he's doing is bad. Mm-hmm. It's all of it's bad. It's bad. It's embarrassing for America. It's a sad place the whole country's come to.
Mm-hmm.
But being distraught about it isn't going to change anything he's doing.
Sure.
And so I just watch it like a cloud in the sky where it's just like, well, that's insane. But
and even if you could do something about it, I think it's sort of like a Sun Tzu sort of thing where it's better to be not let the not let your enemy, quote unquote, disrupt your thinking. It's even if you have the ability, let's say you're I don't know, Chuck Schumer or somebody.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if I was a Justice Department lawyer,
right,
my reaction to the Trump presidency would be different. I'd be looking for ways to expose all of it or undermine him or anything.
Right, but even then,
I'm not, and so there's no reason to let it ruin my day.
But even then, I'm saying like that guy is better served. He's better able to take actions if he's not letting it ruin his day. Right. But he's just like letting it pass through.
You're coming at it with a calm and coming at it with a game plan.
Yeah. So what? And I'm curious too about, so that's like one way passion affects our lives. But also like what then? Why do you do comedy if you like don't care?
I mean, I care about things. I just think like, what would passion for comedy look like other than doing it every day?
Well, then why do you do it?
I'm very passionate for it.
Well, then that's what I'm asking, man. Why?
But like, how would passion for comedy express itself?
I guess because if it,
the way it expresses itself is that I've moved to Los Angeles. I do comedy.
I'm not
every single. No, I know, but like,
yeah.
That's how you can tell I'm passionate for it.
Right.
I don't know. Like, is there a different way that you would?
I guess what I'm asking is,
I should be like yelling in the streets?
No.
I'm just curious, like how else it would express itself.
That's not what I was trying to ask. What I was trying to ask was, what then made you want to do comedy? Like, what makes you want to do comedy? If you have
a deep love for comedy, going back to early childhood, deep love for stand up and sitcoms, and basically obsessed with all of it. And a realization later in life that if that's the thing I care most about, it's worth doing, separate from any sort of if I have a gift for it or not.
Sure. And what does but I guess what is, do you know what's underneath that love? Like, what is it that makes up, like, whether it's something about, I mean, for me, one thing that I really enjoyed at various parts of my life as a teen, and then more seriously when I was like 22 and I actually like started listening to lots of comedy, it was the way that people were able to be totally honest in this way, is this really unique vehicle for empathy and truth telling. And this is one of the, you know, as they say, it was one of the last bastions of free speech or whatever out there, where people can say very uncomfortable, quote unquote, uncomfortable truths. But if you couch it in a joke, it somehow is a societally accepted thing, or at least a sub community accepted thing. And there's something still exciting to me about that this is a, if I can talk about like a bad breakup, or I can talk about my embarrassment, or I can talk about how pathetic I am, but if I'm putting it in this nice packaging, people can actually, not only can they be entertained by it, but they can maybe really connect to that too. I mean, so that's what it is for me.
Your answer is great, and it's not my answer. what you've asked is a very deep question. I don't know my answer, but I'm going to try and answer it right now. But sure, it's definitely not what you just said, which is a totally good reason to do comedy. I'm an only child. My parents both worked. I watched a lot of Comedy Central. I watched it all day long. I would, and my parents are comedy savvy. They'd stay up and watch. We'd watch the top 10 list on Letterman. Even now, my parents, you know, big Colbert and Samantha Bee fans, and they watch SNL. So my parents were aware, are into comedy. And I was just watching all of it. I was watching so many Simpsons episodes, Seinfeld. I was mapping out the schedule of which sitcoms I wanted to see, where I was like, I know for a fact I watched the first season of Seinfeld. No one else was watching it. I watched Simpsons with my parents when it was on the Tracy Ullman show. I watched the season premiere of episode one of Friends. I was watching tons and tons and tons of comedy and tons of stand-up on Comedy Central, which was like most of what they aired in the early days. And I've never thought about this question you've asked before in terms of like, why did it resonate? And maybe it's just because if you can make people laugh at school, you could be popular.
Sure, yeah.
Or you could be... There was definitely like a kid in our school that was tiny. I was small too, but this kid was even smaller. But he was funny. And so he's popular.
Do you remember his name?
Peter Laird, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Nobody look him up on Facebook. Just respect.
I don't think he even went to our high school. So somebody from elementary school that was like... was just the class clown and was funny.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the seed or something where it was like, oh, comedy is this thing that can make people like whatever.
Like make you feel more accepted or something.
Make you popular.
Sure. Well, that's the same thing, right? I mean, being popular is like...
Yeah.
I think it was being popular makes it sound more vain than it actually is, though. Like, is it, know what I'm saying?
I think that was just the spark in fourth grade or something. Maybe it's just like sure. I realizing that comedy was this pivot point.
Yeah,
it's not what kept me in it or why I do it now or anything. But maybe that's what started it or something. I don't know. But like I say, my parents are showing me the Tracy Ullman show. Like my parents, I was watching adult comedy with my parents from a very early age.
Deep cuts.
So yeah, I think I just doubled down on what I was already doing.
I remember, I think sixth grade was the first time I really felt like I was funny. Like, I had certain years of my academic life where I was funny or not funny. Like, I would think through elementary school, I was such a quiet kid. Like, I was hardly talking at all, very shy, classically shy. I don't know why it's not really classically shy. It's just it's the wrong word for whatever kind of shy it is. Didn't talk a lot. Then something happened in sixth grade where I was able to, I was able to be funny. I was able to... like connect to the popular kids liked me. I wasn't quite popular, but the popular kids liked me.
Yeah.
That was the best year ever for my yearbook. End of year signings. Like, hey, funny guy or something. See you next summer or whatever.
And you've been chasing that ever since.
Really have. I mean, because the subsequent years were fucking rough, man. They were rough. A lot of bombing.
I think that's common for everyone
class.
That ends up doing comedies. Like, right?
Yeah.
Very few of us were popular in high school or whatever.
Yeah,
like I had friends and it was fine, but it was for sure an awkward kid.
Every now and then you come across like the Bert Kreischers of the world who were like the super party dudes at like Florida State who were like they've been killing it the whole time, and I totally love Bert Kreischer but also hate him for that.
Yeah, so I like obviously I was just a weird kid.
Yeah,
but it was much later that I realized like, oh, the fact that I just care about this stuff more than other people care about it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like I think I'm funny, but I wasn't the funniest. I wasn't the class clown or something.
Sure. Yeah.
I was quiet too. It's more just that I care about it more than other people care about it.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to do the work.
Yeah. Well, you definitely do the work. I mean, that's something that I think especially, I mean, I think we've both been in LA around the same amount of time, about 6 years ish or something like that. And I remember, I mean, we were just seeing each other at open mics for a while, but then somewhere a couple years ago, you just started producing lots of shit, and you still do, and you have some kind of official role at the clubhouse.
Yeah.
So you're putting your money where your mouth is, and you're really walking the walk in terms of like the total groundwork you're putting into, which,
I'm surprised more people don't produce a show,
right?
It's not that much work. And also it gets way less work as you figure out how to do it.
Right. It gets a lot smoother.
But then you're doing a show all the time and you can do whatever you want on it. And you're not waiting for somebody to return your email.
Right.
You're just doing your thing because you've set it up.
I think it was, for me, it was too, because I waited too long to start producing. I think comics should start producing shit, like real, or like start with just an open mic or something.
Yeah. My early stuff was hit or miss or whatever. Like I was producing too soon.
Right.
People asked me to help out with something or whatever, and like I have no idea what I was doing. But, and I'm still not an expert, but I am producing a lot of stuff, and it's going pretty well. It's like not worried about it.
Yeah, well, I'm starting to produce more stuff too, and I love it for the exact reasons. But like I think for me, what took me so long, because I went through a long period of not producing anything. I think it was twofold. A, it was the fear of it failing, of course, which is like, oh, I can't like produce something and then have it. And in your head, failure. At least for me, when I was like 2-3 years in, failure meant anything short of being like the most popular show.
Yeah.
I was like, no, it has to be like the one everybody goes to. It has to be like the new Palace or something.
If this isn't Showtime at the Apollo.
Right.
We should just quit.
Right. Or even the fucking like the new Chatterbox or whatever the fuck, you know, you want to say. And then the other one was like, I wanted to be asked. I mean, I still want to be asked, of course.
Oh, I wish I was doing so much
stand-up. Everybody book either one of us anytime you want.
I would love to do stand-up on your comedy show.
I'll do whatever show, whatever
fucking
show.
I'll drive to wherever it is.
But, like, that's what I wanted. I wanted to be like, I want to just be selected because I'm so good. But I know there are people who, I guess they're, like the 1% of comedians, I guess, can do that. But even then, they usually are producing shit too.
I don't think it's possible in LA. There's not enough
not
shows.
In LA,
no matter what, no matter how many TV credits you have, you're never going to be booked on enough stand-up shows unless there aren't enough of them. You're never going to be booked on enough of them that you're like getting the stage time you want or need to work on your craft.
Totally. And then, the only other option is if you are a club regular, by which point you've probably already been making it on the road.
But even then, you're not going to be doing enough shows in Los Angeles. Like, you know what I mean?
Totally. You're going to be supplementing it with your road work.
You have
your
name on the wall at the Comedy Store. You're still doing one 1 a.m. spot a week for 7 people.
Right. It's 15 minutes.
And getting booked on one bar show in the Valley or what, you know what I mean? Like it's not.
No, you're totally right.
This was like an important realization like I had, because you think when you start out here, you see people on shows and you're like, oh, if I just got good enough or recognized or credits or eventually I'll be on the shows.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, no, you'll never be on the show. Like, people with credits much better than ours. People with TV appearances aren't doing more stand-up than we're doing. It's not possible to do the stand-up you want to be doing.
Yeah.
In our scene.
Yeah. I mean, that's a unique beast of LA, and I'm sure New York is probably pretty similar.
I think it's not similar. I think in New York there's lots of shows because there's millions of people that will watch comedy in New York.
Oh, yeah. A lot less industry type people.
People that are not jaded to entertainment, people that are at bars anyway and will watch. And so my brief experience with New York, I was there for 2 weeks, so this is a very limited, but it just seemed like there were way more bar shows and it was way easier to get up on them because people were at the shows. Real people would watch any, maybe it's not a big hit, but there's 20 people watching.
Yeah.
Just like if you had 20 people watching in LA, you would be the next Chatterbox.
Right?
You'd build that into a 40 person audience and you'd sell a TV show.
Yeah. I'm going to New York in like a couple months, just for a week, but I'm really looking forward to finally doing some stand-up there.
Way healthier because even if, probably the same number of comedians don't live there, but even if the same number do live there, there's also 10 million plus people that aren't in entertainment.
Yeah.
And think it's cool that you're a comedian and aren't blasé about being an actor or whatever.
Is this the part, do you ever think about moving to New York?
No, not really.
I think about it sometimes just because I
had a great time there. It was really cool. I hope to go back, but it's
I mean, I like I'm talking to like Pedro Salinas, who's moved there, Juan Gico, Eke, and
many of LA's best promising young comedians. Yeah, moved to New York.
I mean, and they say that New York is better. But, for
and I think it's for that reason. It's that you can get the stage time you're seeking out to work on your thing. Like
Totally. Yeah. I think about it, but I think too, just like from an idea of, and I heard this, Rob Bell is this sort of, he's kind of new age-ish Christian former pastor. More now he actually, sometimes he does seminars at the Improv of all places talking about for creative entrepreneurs. But, he talks about the idea of I think about this approach all the time with the comedy scene where most people think their approach to the world is where do I fit in? What pre-existing system can I just slot myself and be a cog in that machine? How can I be a screw or a nut or a bolt or whatever in somebody else's gear? But then there's a different view, which apparently is a certain Jewish type of belief, which is we can create, we're not fitting into God's world. We're helping create the world with God or whoever, with the divine. So in that idea, I think of producing a show or it's taking some empowerment and taking some stuff into your own hands of it doesn't have to be that this is all that exists and these are my only options. Right. I do have the option to make shit happen.
Yeah. Do anything you want.
Yeah. And it's a total, and also I think in terms of did you start having way more empathy for bookers once you started?
Oh, it's impossible to book. There's too many people.
Yeah.
The Gangbuster show has been happening. We do it every Friday at 11 upstairs at the clubhouse. I don't need you to come. It's fine.
It's a great show. Actually, I have a pretty decent video from there from the time
we take real pride in selling Los Angeles Comics videos from the show because
it's a good video.
It's so hard to get a video in LA. No matter how talented you are, because there's no audience at anything.
And Rob Schultz did a good job editing.
And he's a professional editor. We take pride in that. It's one of the reasons we run the show, I think. Mm-hmm. But the show's been happening 2 years. So we've done 120. There's people that have not been on the show.
Yeah.
We've done 120 of them. And there's people that are on my list that I want to have on the show. Not even people that ask me or anything. And eventually I would like to get these other 40 people on the show.
Right.
Because there's just...
There's too many people.
Comedians and not enough stage time.
And I think, I had this total attitude of I was so much more hurt when people I knew wouldn't book me on stuff.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have a concept of that. Of oh, right, there's only so much stage time to go around and there's X amount of people. And also, I wasn't able to think of now I know what I look for when I book people. What am I, you know, and mostly it's do I think they're funny and do I are we cool enough as people? Do I not think they're a terrible person? That's really my two criteria. Are they funny and not an awful human being?
Yeah. There's just too many qualified people applying for this job.
Right. Right. And so did you have that problem with it's entitlement or something? You felt a little entitled to spots when you're younger?
Oh, I mean, I certainly, and it's, that's one of those things that you're trying to turn off that feeling because if feeling that way makes you work harder or send an email to someone you're nervous about sending an email to, a bigger connection or whatever, then that's a good impulse. The impulse to why can't I be on that show?
Right.
If it generates a pot, but if it's just if you're just mad at Steve Hernandez, it's not doing anything for your life. It's just ruining your day. Steve doesn't even know.
Yep.
And so I hope no one's I'm a little worried. I hope no one's mad at me because I have ignored or something. I'm not trying to do that.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
But and you know, I do find myself it's natural to feel stilted or not stilted, but you know, if you want to be on something and you're not, of course, you're gonna feel hurt. But recognizing that emotion and recognizing that it's maybe not helpful anyway to feel that way, and there's no reason to let it ruin your day. You could just be in a good mood.
Well, it's back to meditation, right? And I think meditation totally helps me catch those feelings a lot faster. And it's not even about it used to be I would feel really jealous or something and I would choose to act or choose to not act on it. But now I think I'm able to just identify what's the root of the jealousy? What's the core, what's the underlying thought of that? And is it bullshit? Probably.
Like, and it's, is the whatever show you're upset about, it's not even worth it.
I mean,
the shows in LA aren't very good.
I mean, God bless the Chatterbox. You could never do the Chatterbox and it would be fine for your career. Like, it would be total, like, you wouldn't.
Yeah. Yeah, no, nothing you'll ever do is going to change your career overnight or whatever.
No, like, single thing.
No booking, no show, no TV. We know people that have been on Conan that still work day jobs.
Right. And have to, like, email
There's no part of the chain before or ahead of us that is like, oh, and now I've made it.
Right. And I know we're talking a lot about LA comedy, but I really think these same principles
can apply to
anything. Well, I think we're getting close to wrapping up. I'll give you a choice, because when people don't have a religion, we make one up. But I don't know how you feel about that. We could also, the other alternate is, what's one aspect of, in your case, it would be Buddhism or your Kadampa that you
esoteric
would,
Buddhism,
right? That you would like to change, whether it's wanting the Dalai Lama dead for real, or what?
I mean, that's one of the interesting things about, non-Western Buddhism or non-religious Buddhism, is that if you want to change something, you just change it. It's not, there's nobody's in charge. It's just a self-practice.
People are like, yeah,
it's fine, like, what's one thing about your diet that you want to change? And it's like, oh, I wish I was allowed to eat granola. Like, you could just start eating granola. It's fine. Like, you don't need to, there's no rules. There's no wrong way to do it.
Are you not even, so this isn't a vegetarian type branch? Are any Buddhists vegetarian?
I mean, a lot are, but not by like... I've been vegetarian 20 years. It's one reason Buddhism is the right religion for me.
Like, of course, yeah.
This has never come up at the thing I'm going to.
Mm-hmm.
Because again, it has nothing to... Buddhism definitely has practitioners that are following, strict 1,000 years of tradition and ritual, but Buddhism's a religion, to the extent that it is a religion and not just like a philosophical practice.
Do you wish you had more of a community around your Buddhism?
No.
You're like, I'm cool.
I mean, it's an internal practice.
Yeah.
Do I need to hang out with people talking about yoga we're going to do later? No. Like, you just do it. I don't know, man.
I think a lot of value can be actually, I mean, not that specific example, but
you can do yoga because it's what it does for you. You don't need it to be.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think of it as like, and obviously you're right, that is a totally individual practice in your own, nobody's going to directly help you, I don't think. But like in that, I think in the way that like part of what makes being in New York or LA as a comedian makes you a better comic is you're going to be around people who are also writing, who are also kind of like into the same shit you're into, and you kind of feed off of that sort of secondhand community a little, even as disparate as the community can be in LA and like the lack of community you can
feel. I'm a very competitive person, but I don't feel like I need competitive Buddhism. Like, I'm going to meditate so much better. You won't even realize, because it'll be totally internal experience, but it's going to be better than yours.
Fair enough. Well, you might be interested that this is, I think you might be, it's funny, it's like, it's almost a cliche of this podcast that people say like community is like the one thing they miss from like Christianity or whatever. So you're like, nah, I'm good without it.
Yeah, I think it's fine.
Cool, man. So how about, you want to, what would you like to plug? What shit are you running? Boy. Gangbusters, we covered.
Set list Friday. At the Pack every Thursday at 10:30. Gangbusters every Friday at the Clubhouse at 11 p.m.
Set list, also a great show, by the way.
Jason McGlass and Emo Phillips.
Oh yeah, how the fuck did you start improvising with Emo Phillips?
Nobody knows, but it's I do a 2-person improv show second and fourth Sundays. It'll be with Emo Phillips for the 8th time on, let's say, the 26th of March, and
follow you on Twitter.
Oh, please, at Jason Van Glass on all social media. No one else has my name.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely not. I'll have the link to that in the show notes. Well. Jason, thank you so much for coming.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I will tell you, I was a little nervous at the beginning. I was like, I don't know how this is going to go. You didn't seem that interested, but I think this ended up great.
People feel that way about me all the time. I'm actually very passionate.
I can tell now. It's the passionless thing was a total bullshit.
Very competitive person.
Anyway, thanks, man.
Thank you.
That's the show. Once again, thank you so much to Jason for coming out and getting through that conversation with me. I think it ended up productive and great, and I hope you guys liked it too. If you want more of this show, ChooseYourOwnReligion.com. Love you all. Namaste.
What's a Creative Podcast Network?